Well, hello again, everybody. It is once again another Thursday. This time it is Thursday, the 7th of May, and it is time for another Access to Access webinar where you get to ask the questions of some of the biggest movers and shakers in the industry. And today we have a real treat. This is somebody I'm just so excited to have in for one of these webinars. We have Nomi Prinz. Nomi, you're probably familiar with her. She wrote a great book that came out about a year ago called All the President's Bankers. She's worked on Wall Street for years. She was a managing director at Goldman Sachs. She also worked at Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and Chase. Now she's a renowned journalist, author, speaker. She writes for New York Times and other major publications that have published her work. She's also, and I can't wait to ask her about this, I read in your bio, Nomi, a member of now presidential candidate Bernie Sanders' Federal Reserve Reform Advisory Council. So Nomi's plugged in pretty well. And like I said, this book, All the President's Bankers, is just a must read for everybody. So Nomi, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to visit with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, let me just dive right in. This book, All the President's Bankers, is it about a year ago it came out?
Yeah, it came out the beginning of April, 2014, and the paperback just came out in March this year.
And everybody listening, if you don't have it, if you haven't had a chance to read it, it is, I think it's a history book almost more than anything else. And I was just telling Nomi before we started, I put it in there with G. Edward Griffin's great book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, about just as a must read for you to understand where we are and how we got here. Nomi, I don't know, this would probably be an odd place to start, but when I first got into, we'll call it the business, and I mean, I was way down the food chain. I was just a retail stockbroker back in 1990. But I remember learning in college about the Glass-Steagall Act and how important it was and why it was put in place after the market crash and back during the Great Depression. And it seems like that was ultimately the banker's target all through the 80s and the 90s. And once it was broken apart, that's when everything really kind of got sideways. Can you comment on that? I mean, do you think, was that kind of a pivotal moment when that went away? And I mean, is there any chance, do you think, without a complete breakdown that we'd ever get it re-implemented?
I think the answer to the last question would be, we would have to have a complete breakdown mega more times than the last one, and there would have to be a completely different set of leaders in Washington and on Wall Street and public sentiment being aware of it. So I think the chances, unfortunately, are quite slim, but we can hope. But the Glass-Steagall Act itself was passed in 1933. The first name there, Carter Glass, had been in Washington circles for quite some time. He had been a Treasury Secretary to Woodrow Wilson. He was working with FDR in the Senate when the Glass-Steagall Act was passed. And it was interesting at the time, it was right after the Great Depression, the market crashed in 1929, and there was a understandable lack of confidence in the financial system and in the big banks in particular because of the types of securities they created, the practices they had done that really used public money or depositors' money at their core. Now, at the time, depositors' money was not insured. Right. So when banks went under or when people wanted their money out, there wasn't any sort of security that it would be there for them. It was being used for other purposes. So that was something that not only FDR at the time, and before him even Herbert Hoover, so it was a Republican and a Democrat president back-to-back who wanted to see something done about the situation, but it was also the bankers at that time, oddly enough. The head of Chase at the time, who was a fellow named Winthrop Aldrich, ultimately married into the Rockefeller family and so forth, which was one of the major families running Chase, actually wanted Glass-Steagall to be passed. He wanted this idea of risky securities creation and trading to be separate from people's deposits as a banker who was one of the most powerful bankers in the country at the time. So did a man named James Perkins, who was running National City Bank, which was what we now know as Citigroup at the time. So there was this combination of the population being oppressed by the economic destruction and the Depression, but also being scared of the banking system, FDR knowing it had to be changed, knowing these people, being friends with these people, as I talk about in the book, for years, and some of these bankers themselves wanting a shift. That all related to the separation of Glass-Steagall Act, the separation of securities creation, trading, risk-taking activities from people's deposits. It also led to the establishment of the FDIC to insure those deposits. And for decades thereafter, there was a lot more stability in the financial system and in the American economy. But over the years, and particularly when a new set of bankers came to the heads of some of those institutions in the 70s, they started wondering if it wouldn't be better to use those deposits as their core to actually do the securities creation, lend in more complex ways, trade more, find more ways to make money. And so, yes, under both Republican and Democrat presidents, Republican and Democrat bank leaders, there started to be this real push to dismantle all sorts of things, dismantle the idea of having states having banks be allowed to merge across state lines, which actually happened under Clinton. The idea of banks being able to do insurance business and trading business, investment banking business, and this commercial deposit type lending business all in one roof, that was the culmination of a couple decades of hitting Glass-Steagall, culminated in an act called the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which was passed under the Clinton administration in 1999. And the recent crisis and crises that have happened since then, and we go back actually to the Enron and WorldCom scandals as well as the subprime crisis and what we're dealing with now, are a direct result of the dismantling of the Glass-Steagall Act and the passing of what was called the Financial Modernization Act or the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, because it enabled banks to really play more and leverage more individual deposits and also become bigger. It allowed them to merge and become bigger and therefore control not just more deposits but also more capital, more power in Washington without any accountability from Washington. There had been accountability sort of for decades before that, sort of a mutual alliance of individuals and institutions that weren't trying to sort of wreak havoc on the American economy, although they still wanted their banks to grow. And that all sort of dissolved starting in the 70s, going to the 80s, and ramping up in the late 90s and through today.
And so now here we sit. I have a stat from your book that said by 2012, the big six banks held $9.5 trillion in assets, an amount equivalent to 65% of GDP. And what the estimates of quadrillions in derivatives that are all kind of linked together in this daisy chain of counterparty risk. I mean, how does this ever? I guess there's really no going back, is there? I mean, the banks now are so much involved in the economy; they really are too big to fail. And yet, it seems to be that we've reached the end of where the Fed can bail them out. So where does it go from here, Nomi?
Yeah, I mean, we are in this new era of the banks being subsidized by the Fed to a large extent. I mean, there was the sort of bailouts that happened in the wake of the financial crisis, but zero interest rate policy, quantitative easing, the Fed carrying a book now of $4.5 trillion worth of debt securities, about $1.7 trillion of which are kind of toxic or badly devalued mortgage securities from the same big banks that the Fed has purchased from them, given them money to purchase at full value. So there's so many ways that these larger institutions are subsidized, and they've all grown predominantly the big six banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley have all pretty much grown, the ones that take deposits in deposits and certainly in assets from the financial crisis period. So they've come out okay. So, you know, where do we go from here? They're not going to be getting any smaller. The voices in Washington that talk about pretending is an unfair word, but the ones the few who want to change that fundamentally, structurally in the banking industry get completely sidelined. And that's why going back actually is a better answer for stability going forward. It's just no one seems to know that or care, because there's just so many intertwined relationships, and the banks have been allowed to be subsidized and continue on their way after the financial crisis. So it's a little hard. But again, back in those times, back after the crash of 29 into the Depression, these were bank leaders and Washington leaders who were on the same page as wanting to find ways to stabilize that financial system together. They were Republicans and Democrats. There was much more of a mutual decision-making process that had some concept of long-term impact, of risk on the system, of a lack of
right.
confidence. And we don't have that today. Everything's been sort of plastered over. Everyone who was involved in architecting the bailouts and the subsidization of the banking industry as it stands have all gone on to write books and talk about how they did the right thing and how there was
right.
moral hazard and they rose to the occasion. And they're all sort of heroes, you know, from Tim Geithner to Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson and so forth. That we have this delusional vision from Washington as to what's going on and therefore what will happen in the future.
Well, and here we sit on a Thursday morning in May, and the we've been talking about this at TF Metals Report the last couple of weeks, that the move in the 10-year German Bund over the last 2 weeks has been astonishing, from 5 basis points to, I think it hit 80 overnight. And it almost seemed like a near meltdown was happening in the global credit markets. And all of these banks that have grown even beyond this too big to fail, you know, level that they had in 2008, they all seem to be intertwined. And they all have these, you know, all these derivative bets that are linked together. But and we teeter on the edge, it seems, even as recently as last night, of some major losses. And I mean, is there any other way out at this point for these banks other than continued subsidization, other than continued central bank support? I mean, that's, I guess, what seems to be my biggest concern, you know, is how will the next crisis be papered over, you know, pun intended, I guess, Nomi, as we've continued down this path?
Well, first of all, it's astonishing that we're all even on this path to this
yeah.
extent. It's astonishing that we have $4.5 trillion of support from the Fed beyond all the other policy supports, that there's like $2.5 trillion of the ECB, that the People's Bank of China is continuing to reduce their rates and pump more liquidity into their
yeah.
system, and that every single time it looks like any of this is going to end from any part in the world, you have these backups in the bond market and in the stock markets, but on the days where that sort of fear hasn't been put into, you know, into the day's news, then markets tend to go up. So it's a very volatile, fragile environment, and they have been able to keep this going, the central banks, for quite some time. And of course, the governments that are associated with central banks seem to think, for the most part, this is all okay, or just don't even comment anymore. So it's, where can it go? That's, the banks are still all interdependent. The foreign exchange markets, the LIBOR markets, the interest rate markets, the derivatives markets, they all have risk to either each other or to clients that have multiple risks to all of them, or you know, any sorts of combinations of those things within securities or just in their general trading practices or trading, day-to-day trading. So it's all very much interlocked. So yes, if one thing or two things or three things kind of fall apart at the same time, you get this downward pressure in the markets, but also at some point central banks will run out of ammunition. There's only so far down you can drive rates below zero,
yeah.
Or near zero for so long. I think the reason that we haven't completely fallen off a cliff and this papering over continues and it's global is because there's still countries that haven't gotten to zero. I mean, that's really what it is. It's sort of this push downward. And even the Federal Reserve continues to talk about maybe raising rates. Maybe they won't. Maybe they will. The media talks about maybe they will. Maybe they won't. The reality is, even if they do, the slightest movement is gonna unleash a lot of negativity in these markets, because they're counting on the financial system that fuels the trading that goes on a regular basis, that backs derivatives, that is involved in all of these aspects, counts on this cheap money, whether it comes from the U.S. Fed or whether it comes from the ECB or wherever it is. That's what is being counted on.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you one more question before we get to the questions that are stacking up in queue. And again, for anybody that wants to ask a question of Nomi, use that questions tab in your GoToWebinar control panel and type it in. We've already got three of them waiting, but I want to ask you one more, because you made me think about this. You know, there was this a G20 meeting, I guess it was at the end of last year, Nomi, where all of the G20 participants agreed to kind of change their, and then this is in my layman's terms, their banking laws, to make depositors of the banks creditors and down the food chain. You know, a guy like me reads that. People here at my site read that and we think, oh man, they're setting up the infrastructure for bail-ins the next time this happens. I mean, in your professional opinion, when you see things like that, is that something, am I reading that right? Is that something that's kind of on your radar?
No, absolutely. Okay. And whether we call it bail-ins or whether we just call it grabbing people's cash, yeah. You know, it's a way to utilize the real foundation of why these banks have been able to operate as they have in the deregulation that's happened in the industry throughout, you know, the U.S. with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, throughout the world, because everything is structured sort of on the same basis between investment banking and trading and people's deposits, is that already these deposits and the mass of them at these larger institutions are what gives them this too big to fail credibility with respect to the government. And if banks can utilize those deposits yet another way, i.e. to back them if they start to have losses and they don't have the same subsidization coming in from governments or central banks, that's very, very dangerous. But from their perspective, it's a great thing. It's another place to go. The Federal Reserve was another place to go back when it was created in 1913. It was created in the wake of a large panic in the banking system in 1907, and it was created by the bankers that were involved in its creation to give them an out, to give them backup in the case of future emergencies. And so, you know, fast forward to today, and the idea of using people's cash, right, people's deposits, also for those emergencies, is very scary, but from their perspective, it's a logical evolution.
Yeah, I suppose that's right. Well, it certainly, we saw that, all those headlines last year, and it just seemed like, I don't know, hopefully they're not setting it up as in preparation for an eventuality, but gosh darn. We'll see where we go from here. I've got, like I said, a couple of questions in queue, and so if you're ready, I'm just going to dive right in. The first one comes from Arthur. And this is just kind of a wide open question. He just wants to know, in your personal opinion, how stable right now is the current financial system? And here's a nice open question for you, Nomi. When will it crash?
That's a great question, Arthur. I don't actually know, but I will say that what one of the things I was alluding to before is that the financial system is not stable. These conversations about, you know, Citigroup people or researchers talking about how we need to abolish cash, or Jamie Dimon, the CEO chairman of JPMorgan Chase, saying that banks will face more volatility in the future because they've been too regulated in the wake of the financial crisis. None of these are very rational, positive statements about the stability of banking for various reasons. So the plastering over, the support from cheap money and the purchasing of debt securities from these institutions has really kept a lot of them looking much more solvent than they actually would be otherwise. And it's allowed them to engage in some of the same practices that got us into this particular subprime crisis, because the same sorts of things they're doing with subprime loans, they're doing with commercial loans, which also have nefarious credit quality and so forth. So yeah, they're sort of doing the same thing in different areas. So that makes it less stable as well. And the fact that they're all larger than they were into the financial crisis also makes it less stable, because you have too big to fail has become much bigger. And so that's also a problem. When will this all happen? I firmly believe it's related to how much actual time and process globally these central banks are going through. So the ECB has another year or so that they had committed to buying, you know, cover bonds from Deutsche Bank, or basically buying, you know, their bad securities and giving them money to keep them solvent in the process. That plan has some time to go. The People's Bank of China continues to do things in terms of their rates. You know, some of these other central banks are dropping rates to lower or considering ongoing negative. So as long as that's all in play, the market continues to have that fragility and volatility, but has the appearance of, in general, the financial system and the markets staying up because these things are still in play. So I look at it like we're really fragile, though there will continue to be volatility and these downward moments along the way. But in terms of an actual crash, it either requires a number of things happening at the very same time and the sort of ending of the strategy of buying bonds and reducing rates globally to keep things together. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, whether things start to go in the end of this year into the middle of 2016, which is when a lot of, at least the European plans supposedly come to an end. I think you're going to see kind of more negative sort of sputtering, and then if a few bad situations all happen at the same time with respect to loans, with respect to some international crisis, whatever, then you're going to see a much quicker downward spiral.
If we get that cascade again, Nomi, I mean, and again, it could cut, as you said, the securitization they're doing with these, loans again, and subprime auto loans, you know, where you can trade in your car and pay off your current car and buy a new car and all that kind of stuff. If you get that kind of cascading run of defaults again, like we had in 2008, how would the system be saved this time? Would it be through bail-ins? Would it be through almost a nationalization of banks?
I think you would see whether it's bail-ins actually confiscating cash or whether it's just disallowing, which is starting to happen anyway, large transactions of cash coming out. I think that would definitely be a reaction. And I think it would be a reaction that would be rubber stamped by the Federal Reserve, by government policy, because
right.
The same leaders, the same banks would say, hey, if we have all our cash go out, then we're not going to be able to preserve things and we'll have another crisis and an Armageddon will happen, which was all the stuff that was being said into the 2008
yeah.
crisis period to save them. So all of that will be said. This is just like one other aspect. One other aspect of money, and it really takes us back to the pre-1929 days where people's deposits weren't secure. So now it's like we have the FDIC, we've had, you know, these decades of policies where at least their deposits are supposed to be secure, and the system is so fragile, and the financial leaders have been able to work with Washington leaders and central bank leaders to preserve themselves, that it's almost like even though we have deposit insurance, it may not matter.
Right, right. Well, all right, then this next question then comes from a listener named Russ, and this kind of gets to the timing of things again. Russ says, is he delusional, or does the unraveling of all these schemes seem to be time compressing? Can they keep this mess going on forever? And it gets to the sustainability thing, you know, that which can't be sustained is unsustainable. I mean, and we talk about
right.
the exponential growth of debt and all that stuff. I mean, is there, can this be kept on going forever, or does it reach a point where it begins to fall apart?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think as long as there's physical numerical room to continue to create debt and drop rates globally, I think there's going to be this sort of, not forever, but sort of this nearer term sputtering effect of various central banks still helping things. Because even now, if you know, if Janet Yellen comes out and says we might raise rates at some point, or we're changing the word patience to whatever,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's a negative reaction. But then the People's Bank of China will drop its rate, and all of a sudden those markets will go up, and our markets will go up. So there's still this sort of trading around the globe of these policies that subsidize things. But I do think, you know, again, it comes to an end when there's no room beneath zero to go, and we do continue here and abroad to issue a lot of debt
right.
To support this, which isn't necessarily going into the real economy through the banks that are being sustained by having this extra debt and extra liquidity in the market to help them. It's not necessarily as if small business loans or more things that go to more people are being renegotiated, better terms for them, or being extended to them. It's all still about trying to pile on different types of securities and leverage and derivatives and so forth to make money at the expense of long-term stability.
Yeah. All right. The next question then, as part of that strategy to prop things up, next question comes from Ian, and it's basically about how much faith you put in U.S. government statistics, because we all, I mean, tomorrow we're going to get the what I call the BLS BS, which is the unemployment numbers each month that always seem to leave you scratching your head, whether it's the establishment survey, the household survey, the participation rate, and all
right.
that kind of stuff. You know, we've seen the macro data for the U.S. economy just go straight in the toilet this year.
Right.
It seems to a lot of folks, including Ian, that some of this data is managed to create as as the great gold guy Jim Sinclair says, as kind of management of perceptions. So
right.
how much
Isn't that
stock
this
do you
whole
put into
part
that?
of the yeah campaign? Is that employment stats and people like Shadow Stats, Paul Craig Roberts, people have really dug into these numbers, but the net effect is the headline unemployment rate looks like it has continued to go down quite substantially, almost in half since Obama took office. But in reality, the participation rate, people looking for jobs, is at one of its worst periods. And so, and the kinds of jobs that are being created tend to be more temporary. People have to be holding more than them. They don't have the benefits they once had. So even if they look decent on paper, the stretch that those salaries have to make relative to what they had to make on expenses, for rent to healthcare to university costs in the past is much, much greater. The Fed's own survey, which is interesting because they talk about how their policies have worked and they keep them going, but their own survey last year that came out actually earlier this year, but on numbers up through then, on consumer debt statistics and inequality statistics show that inequality has in fact risen since these policies took place in the wake of the 2008 crisis. So even though the market is up, not as many people are partaking in that, although people will have to suffer the downside. And companies have been buying back their own shares because they have this cheap money from their companion banks, because it's sort of like the big banks and the big companies get the cheap money and actual individuals don't. And so they've been buying their shares, and that's how the effect of making things look good on the surface, but them not being good beneath the surface. So then you go to GDP numbers, and often they'll look at production and they'll look at things that have come from these companies or from the financial system that aren't necessarily real, because they too are being predicated on this cheap money that's been flushed into the system and not on long-term growth or creating better jobs or creating better benefits or any of those things that might be more stable to the economy. So it's like this combination of those numbers, which only choose to look at things a certain way, and that's even if they're remotely accurately capturing data, but even what they do capture looks quite weak when you look at all the numbers that are coming out. Not the ones that get touted at the headline,
right?
But the ones that are actually when you dig through the reports.
Right. And so do you put, I guess, in the end, the validity of the statistics, you think that they are accurately tabulated and put out there, or is it all part of kind of a broader sense of trying to, I guess, just only focus? I mean, does the media out there trying to only focus on the good statistics and not so much on the bad statistics?
Well, I mean, most of the media, again, going back to the unemployment statistics, the data doesn't actually look good except for the headline number. And so, whether it's being compiled right or not, their own reports, if you dig through them, don't actually look so good. It's just that the headline number looks better just because of how it's tabulated and possibly how it's massaged. But the media tends to focus on the headline number, whereas, again, in those reports, in the Fed's reports of what's going on in inequality, in everything, if you actually dig in, beneath the focus, or to a lot of folks who are doing more of this work in independent media, you actually see that whether the data going in or not is being analyzed properly, it's not even in itself showing tremendous stability in growth for sort of the general economy and the general population. So. I don't know to what extent it's being massaged. I think it's actually worse that even if it wasn't massaged, it looks bad.
I guess that's a good way to put it.
Mostly does. Now, that's how I look at it. Whether it's being manipulated or not, it doesn't even have to be, because what's coming out, whether it's been manipulated or not, doesn't actually look good if you dig beneath the surface of these reports.
It's so terrible in the first place. Well, and Nomi, you're being very generous with your time, and I really, really appreciate it. And I know everybody listening is really benefiting from hearing from you. I just have one more question in queue, and so I'll pass that one on to you. I guess it's almost kind of a personal question. This comes from Matt. I mean, you seem like such a nice person, and you're doing, your heart's in the right place, and this book is so great. How in the world did you ever work for Goldman Sachs? And and the second part is, how did that end? What caused you to leave there?
That's a really good question. I had been in banking for a while and sort of around the world, different companies. I'd been at Chase and Lehman and Bear Stearns in London, and then I got to Goldman Sachs, and I wasn't there very long. I mean, it's a thing that gets tagged with my bio, speaking here together. But I was there basically a year and a half before, or a little bit more than that before I resigned. So we didn't really mesh very well
I can
in
imagine.
terms of who I was and who they were. And I think some of the same people that kind of were running the division I was in, which was the FIC division, Fixed Income Currency and Commodities division, are basically now running the firm. So it's like, even though there are a lot of different divisions in the firm, the ones that happen to be running my division that I wasn't particularly enamored of, are the ones, you know, like Lord Blankfein and Harvey Schwartz and so forth that are now on Gary Cohen on top of the firm. So, you know, so that's kind of what I contended with. I left right after 9/11. I mean, I resigned right after 9/11. So there was also a sort of push towards my wanting to leave anyway, and that was sort of the nail in the coffin in terms of actually, you know, life's too short. I just don't need to be here. It's not pleasant. I want to, you know, go. And that kind of happened right after that in terms of my resignation. But I think even there was a real feeling within the firm, and the industry was already going in this direction. It's not like every other firm was fabulous, but there was certainly a big difference to me in terms of, you know, the culture at Bear Stearns. And of course that firm doesn't exist anymore. And Goldman Sachs at the time that I joined Goldman in 2000, because Goldman really had much more of an internal pressure to, but to make money. I mean, they all had pressure to make money, but to make money off of you know, finding these, you know, elephant deals with clients, and not necessarily analyzing the downside of deals. I mean, even at Bear, I had looked at downsides to credit risk as, you know, the whole time I was there, so that when I would talk to clients, I had the analytics that I built or that my team built to show, you know what, here's what happens if it goes wrong. Credit spreads widen by X, if volatility goes up by Y, and that was something that really wasn't shown or really supported, you know, from sort of internal budget perspective at Goldman. So it was much more about internal politics and everything else. So there's a lot of things that I found incredibly distasteful from shortly after arriving there.
Yeah. And now you've been free for over a decade and have written this fabulous book. Hey, thank you so much. I want to kind of transition to the way we usually wrap up here in these A2A webinars with something I call the Final Four. Just kind of four quick questions just to kind of on the way out. So you can usually answer them with a sentence or even just a couple of words. If you're ready, I'll lay them on you.
Sure.
All right. I mentioned as we got started, I read in your bio that you were part of Senator Sanders' Federal Reserve Reform Advisory Council. Is that still an active thing?
I don't think it is. I mean, he certainly does so much relative to everything and Federal Reserve in terms of wanting audits and that and more transparency and that sort of thing. And that was what we were really focused on at the time. So I think it's evolved from, you know, things that we had talked about at that time and were necessary to him being more directly involved among his other issues in trying to get them to sort of change how they report and what they do with the securities they have and how they get them and that sort of thing.
It'd be interesting to see if he talks about it much now that he's running for president. All right. Second, obviously do you still live in New York? Or you've
No,
lived
I
there?
Live in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. Well, then I should ask you this about Los Angeles, but since you're not in New York anymore, but my question is, I'm always looking for a good restaurant in New York. What's your favorite?
Oh my goodness! I don't even know that anymore. That's terrible. I've not lived in New York for quite some time.
Right.
But
well, then, hold on.
No, I'll tell you what it is. I'll tell you what my favorite restaurant is because I was just there when I was last visiting. There's a pizza place called Arturo's the West Village, and it has like the most amazing like brick oven pizza. It has a great atmosphere, sort of all old school. There's always someone at the piano playing or singing, so that's kind of my favorite go-to place when I come to New York. I try to hit it almost every time if I have moments when I'm there.
All right, I'm writing that one down. Thank you. All right, third, we get to play like we're on CNBC Squawk Box. What's your NFP number for tomorrow?
I have no idea.
Good for you. That's a good answer.
I don't know. You know, the jobless claims weren't great this week. I mean, I think all these figures are a bit sort of lagging of what's really happening. I don't think company earnings were really that good. So I'm going to go for even the headline number being, you know, a sort of a tenth worse than it was last time. But again, as we talked about, that's not That is not necessarily indicative of job quality or stability.
Exactly. But give them all something. Give the algorithm something to trade off of, and it'll give CNBC something to get all excited about. All right. Lastly, do you own any physical precious metal, gold or silver?
I actually own some physical silver.
Okay. Well, then that kind of leads me to the kind of the 4A, because this is a question I always ask everybody. If I gave you today, we're sitting out in LA at one of those fancy schmancy bars there in Beverly Hills having lunch, and I forked over an envelope with 1,200 Federal Reserve notes in it, Nomi, and you had to take that cash and go buy yourself an ounce of gold or 70 ounces of silver, which would you buy?
Again, they're very highly correlated. Silver tends to be, bashed more on the downside, and sometimes takes a little bit more rising on the upside. But I think ultimately, as a long-term investment, I'd probably do two-thirds silver, one-third gold.
Fair enough. Because you mentioned you only have physical silver. What has gone into that? If you don't mind me asking, what was the rationale in buying some?
Same idea that it was basically a less ex, you know, for everyone, it's a less expensive way to sort of play gold. I mean, there is more risk attached to it, but on a long-term view, if you don't have to use that particular cash right away, it was just a less expensive way to sort of play the same metals.
Understood. Understood. Well, Nomi, thank you so much. This has just been tremendous. Your book, again, All the President's Bankers, can be found at Amazon. We'll have a link here on this page. I encourage everybody. I mean, if you don't have it, if you haven't read it, pick it up. Is there a sequel? Is there an updated second edition coming out? Anything like that we need to know about?
Well, the paperback was updated, so I think the one that just came out in March, and I think Amazon is selling it for, I don't know, like $15 right now. So, I mean, they have a pretty discounted version of it, but that had any updates would have gone into that.
It's fabulous. And again, I encourage everybody to check it out. Nomi, thank you so much for your time. Hopefully we can do
Thank
this
you.
again someday soon. And I wish you a great rest of your day out in Los Angeles, and hopefully the ground is terra firma today.
Thank you all very much. Thank you.
All right, have a great rest of your day.
You too.